Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Welcome to the latest edition of the Football Writers Podcast, featuring me, Mike Calvin, Miguel Delaney of The Independent, and Art DeRoche of The Athletic. Hands up, we've all given Ole Gunnar Solskjaer a good kick-in this season. Doubts deepened when Manchester United were humiliated by Spurs. But credit where credit is due. The response from the manager and his players has been exceptional. Nothing is beyond Marcus Rashford at the moment. Off the pitch, he's a national treasure, compassionate, passionate, and inspirational. On it, in his day job, he scores Champions League goals for fun. Hat-trick in 15 minutes? Why not? United found a system that suited them against Red Bull Leipzig. So, Migs, was that the most significant win of Solskjaer's managerial career?
I'd probably put it second to his initial win in Paris Saint-Germain in that regard, because obviously that was the real kind of landmark, probably the result that got him this job in the first place. But this now might be one that ensures he definitively keeps it for some time. I mean, we've given him a lot of criticism in this podcast. I've probably given him most. And I do have to say, I mean, what he's done in this spell is usually impressive. The response to A, the 6-1 to Spurs, and then B, this appalling run of fixtures. And let's be fair, it looked like this could really end it. Given the form they were on, given how shambolic they looked against Spurs, it looked like this is going to be the negative spiral, to use that famous Andre Villas-Boas quote in 2012, that eventually saw him lose it. And now we're kind of about halfway through that run, he's stabilising the league and he is flying in the Champions League. I mean, really, they've beaten their two biggest rivals in the group, Paris Saint-Germain away, now Leipzig at home. That result last night, not just a win, but not just a usually handsome win, given it was 5-0, but also there was a convincing nature, first in the way he dealt with Leipzig from the start, and also, as in the PSG game, with the way he responded to kind of nuances and the rhythm of the game and the way the subs worked so well for him. And I actually think in some ways it was tactically more impressive than the Paris Saint-Germain game. And now everything just looks so different.
Yeah, well, I suppose in Europe they've beaten last season's finalists and the semi-finalists in the Champions League. They seem to have hit on the right system, don't they? That diamond, it seems to suit Paul Pogba and Bruno Fernandes.
Yeah, I think when you look at the midfield options that United have, especially after their summer business bringing in Donny van de Beek, when we were talking on earlier podcasts, we were kind of wondering where van de Beek would fit in if they were going to keep that midfield free. I don't think many of us thought he would just slot into that, and that hasn't been the case. With the diamond, I think there's more scope to bring him into the side, as well as have Paul Pogba do what he did so well last night in terms of breaking from that left side of the midfield to kind of slide in passes for Mason Greenwood. It was in the first half, but of course that could be Martial and Rashford too in later games, and then you've got Bruno Fernandes as well, who can fit into that. When you look at the midfield options United have, I think also that diamond can help in terms of just bringing a bit more of a shield for the United defence, where they've had issues throughout the season. Of course, they've improved in recent weeks, but having shield in front of them like Matic or maybe Fred, who's a bit more mobile in the coming weeks, could help them push forward from what has been an encouraging couple of weeks.
Yeah, talking of the last couple of weeks, there's nothing now beyond Marcus Rashford, is there? Miggs. You know, he's had 223 games for Manchester United, 74 goals, another 11 goals for England. Yet that's almost dwarfed by his social impact as well. You know, to do that, what it, you know, to score that hat trick, given everything that he's been through in the last sort of couple of weeks, is extraordinary, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's an incredible escalation of form. And I think there's even something else that's impressive about Rashford here. And I don't think this should be overlooked, is that whatever about his impact on the pitch, there was a slight danger going into this season that he could have lost his place in the United side. Even when Cavani came in, it looked like, and given Solskjaer's clear preference for Greenwood towards the end of last season, it looked like one of Rashford or Martial could well miss out more regularly. And there just had been that little bit of doubt. Yeah, here we are now, and he's not just established himself as the most prominent figure, the most prominent football figure off the pitch, but now has re-established himself as United's decisive player. And now with four goals in Europe this season, it's remarkable.
Yeah.
And testament to his own character in a different way to his what has been such impressive work with as the phrase goes, Rashford essentially being the leader of the opposition.
You've got, you know, also we're dealing with footballers as you know, hugely public figures, aren't we, Art? And let's dwell on Mason Greenwood if we could. You know, there've been a few sort of mixed messages about him recently. Is he a generational talent, and I'm thinking in terms of the new or the next Rooney, that really requires very careful protection by the club and his manager?
I wouldn't want to throw generational out there, because I think that's a word that gets overused now, especially on Twitter, when you look at some of the debates that go on in the kind of sphere.
We all fall into the trap, mate. We all fall into the trap.
He is an exceptional talent. And I think the way he started the season building off of last year is nothing but encouraging. I know he had that little episode when England went to Iceland, but I think he's come out of that fine. I think Phil Foden's come out of that fine in terms of responding with performances on the pitch. You see how Greenwood played last night and as well beforehand, and you've seen how Guardiola still relies on Phil Foden, really, when you see him bringing him off the bench against West Ham and him ultimately having an impact on the game. In terms of Greenwood and how he's managed by the club, I think that's something that's important for all players, really, not just Greenwood himself. I think there has to be a kind of care for these players not to overexpose them and have them damaged by that. I think there is sometimes a danger of throwing players into these situations too fast and it being a bit too much for them to handle. But going off his performances on the pitch, I think just giving him more chances to prove himself there, which he is doing extremely well, I think that will put him in good stead to carry on impressing the way he has done so far.
Yeah, I don't know what you think, Art, but what struck me about him scoring that goal against Leipzig was just the calmness of the finishing. That was way beyond his years, wasn't it?
Yeah, I think when most strikers or most young strikers get into that position, you might feel they're a bit tempted to just lash it into the back of the net. Whereas with him going across the keeper with a slightly more light finish, it was exactly what was needed. And I think it was something that just showed how aware he is of his surroundings when he's on the pitch and what is best suited to that specific moment in time. And that's the sort of thing that is going to set him apart from other strikers, other forwards, not just at Manchester United, but in the Premier League as well.
Mm. Lest we forget, Miggs, you know, football is a fashion business. Now, Julian Nagelsmann, that was his heaviest defeat as a manager. He's probably the worst dressed man in football, I would suspect, given what he was up to last night. Do you expect to see him in the Premier League soon? You know, because we had been talking about him, haven't we, as, you know, this potential successor to Solskjaer or Pep Guardiola. Do you think he will inevitably come to the Premier League?
Oh yeah, completely. And I don't think even that we should read in. I mean, there's been a little bit of commentary since last night about, you know, this sets things right, that he's been overpraised, that Solskjaer schooled him and all this. But I think it's just one of those results that happen. I mean, it shouldn't be forgotten in all of this that ultimately Manchester United are a much, much wealthier club than Leipzig. And for all the kind of discussion about Leipzig as basically just, you know, and the problematic element of them being what is essentially a franchise of a drinks brand, in terms of their actual financial power as a football club, it's not that great. It's one of the reasons Timo Werner left. And when it did come right down, and this isn't a takeaway from what Solskjaer did last night in the situation, when it comes like right down to it last night, Leipzig have a relatively thin pool of talent and quite a young pool, then Manchester United are able to bring on the quality of Rashford or Bruno Fernandes. I mean, that's a significant difference. And in that sort of circumstance, managers like Nagelsmann, no matter how good they are, they will occasionally take a beating. I mean, you know, if Fergie, you know, the greatest of all, if you want to call him that, when he was at Aberdeen in a similar situation, took a 5-0 pasting to Liverpool. All right, this United aren't that Liverpool, but it will happen. And I don't think it takes away from his overall status. I think he is still one of the brightest coaches in football with among the best ideas. That was what was particularly impressive about Solskjaer last night, that he negated what Leipzig do well, especially at that point in the game in the second half when it was 2-0 and it looked like it could just turn. But yeah, it's still nearly every big club should still be looking at Nagelsmann as potentially their next hire. He is that good, even if his clothes are not.
Yeah, I think he needs a personal dresser personally, but there we go.
But he got a bit chippy about that after the game, actually.
Did he?
Did you see that?
No, I didn't, no.
Yeah. He was asked about it and then kind of say, like he was not in the mood for any sort of joking about his... he was told, you probably won't wear this get-up again because it's unlucky. And he was not given the interview or anything.
So, Art, Arsenal are at Old Trafford on Sunday, obviously a club you know well. Is it a definitive test for them, given that recent defeats have exposed some weaknesses?
I think in terms of the magnitude of the game, it will obviously carry a lot of weight because of the fact it is Arsenal at Manchester United and they haven't won at Old Trafford since 2006, where Adebayor scored to seal the victory. And I think Arsenal have come close in recent years, but not being able to get over the line kind of just hammers home how much of a test it is for them to go to Old Trafford. In terms of it being a defining test, I'm not sure if that will be the case just because of the way everyone started the Premier League this season. No one's really started that well, that consistently. And I think even if they were to lose, they'd still be in with a chance to claw back at United, Chelsea, teams like this for the possible Champions League places, even though I think it's more likely that they'd filter into the Europa League places. In terms of the weaknesses in the team, I think the way Mikel Arteta has tried to change the shape of the team as well since the international break has maybe played into that a little bit, because as we've all seen since the restart in the summer, he's been quite reliant on the back three and then changing that against Leicester. Arsenal looked good in the first half with David Luiz, who was a key man, but once he came off injured, that's when stuff started to unravel. Ultimately, they lost control of the game and Jamie Vardy popped up again at the Emirates. So I think that is an area where he will want to improve in terms of just developing a more confident attacking style when using a back four. But then again, I think even though United have come away with a great win against Leipzig, Arsenal will feel confident that they can go to Old Trafford and unsettle them the way Tottenham did and try and get at least 3 points from the game.
There is a sense, isn't there, Migs, that Arsenal's defence still is that, you know, weakness where, you know, there's even talk of Mustafi getting a new contract. Arteta has come out publicly and said he regrets leaving William Saliba out of his 25, which always struck me as a strange one, that, because, you know, how can you pay £27 million for someone and then basically say, well, we're leaving him out because we don't think he's ready?
Yeah, it's odd. And I think even that speaks to, I suppose, what is it, transitional period at Arsenal as well. And you talk about the defence there, I agree, and I think that's one reason why Arsenal have actually looked so dull of late. I mean, they were better in the first half against Leicester, but I think one of the reasons we're not seeing them be as proactive, why they haven't kind of replaced some of the football, say, in the first game of the season against Fulham or in some sparks last season. Although the Fulham game should be put into context, they started the season atrociously, Fulham. But I do think that Arteta has become usually concerned with getting the defence right and making sure the side is actually solid before moving on to the rest of the team. I suppose the problem for us is, and potentially for Sunday, is that it's made for some fairly dull games where and there is just that slight sense that Arsenal haven't kicked on in the manner you might have expected, given they won the cup, given the suggestion in some games of better football. But I suppose it's kind of the nature of where they were when he took over, and a squad that is in flux. And again, the Saliba thing points to just, I mean, he is still adjusting to what were probably a few years of slightly disparate recruitment.
Yeah. What about the midfield balance? You know, we've got Xhaka, who's described as the great survivor of that midfield. What about also the initial impression that you've got of Thomas Partey?
Yeah, I think just touching on Granit Xhaka quickly, I think he is key to that midfield, the way it works for Mikel Arteta's vision, because even whichever system Arteta uses, Xhaka is key to that. In the back four, he's usually the man that drops in between the left back and the centre back to allow the left back to go forward a bit more and have more license to attack, and then also shield the defence in more of a untraditional back three. But then with Partey, I think he impressed very much on his debut in the Europa League against Rapid Vienna, where he showed exactly what Arsenal fans wanted to see. He was effective with the ball. He was brave with his passing, firing the ball into Lacazette, even when it seemed unlikely. And then he was also aware enough in defence to fill in when there were spaces opening up. And I think that's what Arsenal fans were hoping to see from him against Leicester. Started the game okay. He was looking for the ball. He was getting it, doing more of the same. But as the game went on, Arsenal looked to Xhaka a lot more. I know James McNicholas at The Athletic as well wrote a good piece on it where he watched Partey for the entire 90 minutes and kind of detailed exactly what was going on in that midfield. And Partey was getting understandably frustrated that he wasn't receiving the ball as much. And I think when you buy a player like him, who isn't just a man that's going to sit in front of the back four and destroy opposition attacks, I think you have to trust him a bit more with the ball, because he can push Arsenal forward, not just with driving runs, but also with his passing. And I think as the season goes on, that's probably a side of his game that we'll see more in the Premier League as well as Europa League games if he plays in those.
Well, let's dwell, if we could, Migs, on Liverpool. It seems Fabinho's hamstring injury is not as serious as first feared, and he might even be back after the international break. That leaves them basically three games to negotiate. West Ham at home on Saturday, Atalanta next week away, and then Manchester City away on the 8th of November. Is this a critical test of Liverpool's solidarity and strategy and their spirit and their system?
Well, it's also a bit of a test of this, what has really been, I suppose, a kind of crux of the whole Klopp model, in which, I mean, if you look at the way, even the way he talks about these injuries, he doesn't really talk about them because he feels that that creates a bit of a kind of a negative vibe and doubt around the team. And obviously so much of how Klopp plays requires 100% buy-in and thereby no doubt whatsoever. Yet that confronts the reality of this system is very dependent on that kind of just core solidity at the back, which has obviously been personified over the last few years by primarily Van Dijk and then Alisson. And just having those pins there means everyone else can surge forward in the way we see this team at their best. So this could potentially compromise. Like we could really see a return to Liverpool of a kind of 2017, especially if Fabinho's out, given that he can do some of what Van Dijk does so well. In terms of repercussions for the season, I think that would be the bigger issue, whether it allows any doubt to foster. Because even if they, even in pure results terms, like the mats of the campaign, if you want to call it that, if they had a bad spell over the next 3 days, I mean, as Art touched on there as regards Arsenal and how kind of wild this season is, I don't think it would have too much of an effect. I think this isn't a title race where any single result is going to be too fatal. There's going to be a lot of room for error this season. So even if they dropped off against West Ham and City, it's recoverable, particularly for Liverpool with this attack. And also the Atalanta game isn't too much of an issue because they've won the first two games in their group and they're in a pretty comfortable position now. But really, I think the bigger consequence would be if they lost those three games, which feels a bit of an exaggeration given the quality of this side going forward, or if they were maybe that bit unconvincing or lost to City, that it could foster that doubt that Klopp doesn't really need at this moment. This is one thing about this period as well, and why, say, the 1-0 win over Ajax and then the recovery against Sheffield United the weekend were so important, because it did feel there was that, I don't want to say hysteria, but there was almost that kind of frenzy around the Van Dijk injury, and that feeling that had a few more little things gone wrong, it could have created a bit of a chain reaction. And I think that's maybe something that Klopp will be more mindful of than anything else. I don't think the three games in and of themselves are that crucial, but it's more about the atmosphere in the team after it and how much they can dig in.
Because what makes it so fascinating, Art, is that, you know, we're in an age now of deep and ready-made squads, long-term recruitment, yet Klopp here is facing, you know, a really old school challenge of managing on the hoof. He's got to find out what his best options are for these three games at least. You know, does he bring Jordan Henderson into the back four? He knows the system. He's played alongside Van Dijk in the World Cup final. Andy Robertson's played on the left of a three. Then he's got three or four, you know, younger players coming through. Will we see a different dimension to Klopp, do you think, in the next sort of couple of weeks?
I think there's scope for it because the way he streamlined that Liverpool defence, you can't really rely on, of course you can rely on these players, but especially after the summer that they've had, really condensed pre-season and then straight back into the action, even earlier for them because they played in the Community Shield, I think injuries were going to happen. And of course, Van Dijk's injury wasn't expected, it was more of a contact injury with Jordan Pickford. But when you look at the planning, I think that is possibly a case there could have been improvement for. In terms of what happens now, I think the way Liverpool have set up in terms of a very clear way of playing, that will help decide who comes in for Van Dijk. Obviously, there's Gomez and Matip who will be main options as central defenders. And of course, you've got Phillips as well, who's playing in the Champions League. But with these games coming so quick between each other before the international break, if there is rotation, it's going to be completely understandable. And with Henderson, I think, although everyone knows he's a midfielder by trade, if he is at centre-back for a game, I don't think many people would raise their eyebrows at that. And even though he is a player that you're going to expect to be more pressing in terms of a midfield role, I think he will have the discipline to fulfil that role as best as he can. With Robertson playing as left-sided centre-back in the back three for Scotland, that's something that Kieran Tierney has done as well for Scotland, and since coming to Arsenal under Arteta, he's performed extremely well as a left-sided centre-back in the back three. But again, with Klopp, I'm not sure if he will want to just switch shapes for a couple of games and kind of create even more chaos where there shouldn't be. So I think this kind of couple of weeks before Fabinho is back, it's going to be kind of really interesting time to see how Klopp adjusts to the situation. And I think it's going to only prove his worth to Liverpool even more if he comes through it well.
Yeah, well, I suppose his choices, you know, also include, you know, people like Reece Williams, who looks assured, but, you know, let's not forget he started this year in non-league. Nat Phillips, as you mentioned there, are very promising, recently injured. You know, my information is they were ready to sell him for £5 million a couple of weeks ago. Miggs, you know, again, we go back to the fashion business element of football. Hmm. When people were talking about potential recruitment by Liverpool in January of a centre-back, the name Deo Upamecano was at the forefront of speculation. Yet he was taken to school at Old Trafford, wasn't he?
Yeah, and it's the first time I think we've really seen him look that vulnerable. And I think that's interesting in terms of kind of, suppose, the trajectory of centre-halves, and I'm trying more so the trajectory of the position, in that from the way people spoke about him, and in this case, I mean, the way kind of people in recruitment spoke about him, and the way, like, a lot of, you know, top figures in football, he was seen as a rare player like Van Dijk, who could look like a traditional commanding centre-half in the modern era, where I think it's almost impossible to look like a commanding centre-half. Because I think it's a position now with arguably more demands on it than any other on the pitch, bar possibly fullback. Because if you look at a modern, like, compare a modern centre-half to something, say, 15 years ago even, when, say, Cannavaro in the 2006 World Cup, which may be kind of one of the best recent examples of a completely domineering defender in that way. Defender at that point usually had, he was able to sit much deeper, he had his fullbacks very close to him and not halfway up the pitch, and often one, if not two, shielding midfielders in front of him. And he wasn't tasked with starting moves or kind of press coming from everywhere and putting them all under all sorts of pressure. So, I mean, it was, I'm not going to say a more comfortable position, obviously it involved huge defiance and, you know, quality, but it was more about pure defending, and it was easier to concentrate on that. Whereas now, if you're one of the top teams, and especially if you're playing an approach like Leipzig do, or Liverpool do, a centre-half has to start moves, has to face all this sort of pressure, has his full-backs often 60 yards up the pitch, and a lot of movement in front of him, has pressure coming all over him, and then, of course, has to do the basics of defending and suddenly switch. And you talk to coaches and they speak about how one of the issues for centre-half as well is the specialist traits of the position, or the specialist traditionalist traits of the position, they don't get to concentrate on them as much because they've got to ultimately learn, I suppose, a lot of midfield skills and, you know, pure technical ability. And that does kind of, you know, constrain the time devoted to those traditional qualities. So it is a different role. But as you say, Upamecano had looked like someone that he could convince in that traditional way despite this system. Whereas this is the first time we've seen him really exposed in that manner, and especially given the game it was in. But as with Nagelsmann, I don't really think it takes too much away from him. I mean, it's similar with Van Dijk, if you want to make the comparison between them that way. I mean, given how commanding Van Dijk has been in Liverpool, it's easy to forget there were some games at Southampton where, you know, he could look a bit shaky as well. But ultimately, we all knew what his true quality was. And I think it's the same here. But just touching on a point you made there about the squad depth, I think this is a really interesting season in this regard, and potentially a depressing one, because, I mean, we've discussed this podcast before in terms of how, like, you know, and, you know, it's such a live issue in football at the moment with Project Big Picture and all this going on in the background. There has been a hugely ominous financial disparity in the game, and you can look across so many of the leagues, you know, Bayern Munich, Juventus, Paris Saint-Germain, even in England, where the big six or the wealthiest clubs win the majority of their games, the other 14 take fewer points off them. And in the last few seasons, we've had these kind of almost ridiculous 90-plus point seasons. Now, again, that's pretty much completely down to financial disparity. COVID, one thing it has done in that regard, for all the horror of it, it's been this great disruptor and has, as you say, challenged the kind of notion of these deep squads that these clubs have, and created what we hope is an open season. And it's almost been a test to this, though. But wouldn't it be depressing if, in all this disruption, you just ended up with the richest teams winning again? And I think that's what's really interesting about this campaign. Will that kind of model we've seen for the last few years withstand this great disruption? And I suppose the hope is that it's more open, and that this kind of the surprise of this season continue.
Yeah, are we seeing the subtle evolution of Manchester City art? You know, I mentioned that because five players under 25 started that win at Marseille. You know, okay, there'll probably be changes for the game at Sheffield United on Saturday. Is that as I said, a subtle change in strategy, or is it a sign of the broader strain on squads these days? And this is a season that will give chances to a new generation, Phil Foden, Ferran Torres, for instance.
Yeah, I think with that, when you look at Guardiola's spell at Manchester City's, 4 years into his reign now, and you're going to have an element of succession planning. So I think these chances for young players like Foden and Torres, and then you even look at Nathan Ake coming into the side. Of course, he's a bit older, a bit more experienced with Bournemouth, but I think there was always going to have to be a time to blood in these youngsters, and now is probably as good a time as any to get them in and have them truly influencing games. I think if you see the way their season has gone, it may not have gone as planned, but you've got Raheem Sterling as club captain, maybe in more recent games, not something you would have seen last season when David Silva was at the club, when Aguero is much more of a prevalent figure in the team. And I think when you look at the bare bones of Manchester City, Guardiola is going to have to evolve, and his team is going to evolve with him if he wants to continue this project to a position where they can challenge to win the Champions League for once since he arrived. And I think having that depth is going to help them. Of course, with an academy as well that is as strong as Manchester City's, they're going to have players that they can call upon if needed. And I think the way that their season has gone may not be what most of it would have expected, but is something that could maybe be more of a long-term strategy than for the short term.
Yeah, do you feel, Migs, as probably I do, that there's almost a now or never feel for this particular group at City? You know, I'm thinking, you know, Aguero, there are signs of vulnerability. You've got Gundogan and Bernardo Silva declining forces in midfield. There's a sense that the clock is ticking.
Yeah, totally. And I mean, I think we're already into the stage where you could argue that the great team of 2017 to 19 is actually finished. Because not finished in terms of that these players are done, more so too many of its key players have either moved on or no longer quite have the status they did. And I mean, if you talk about a team as defined by its core 11 playing kind of more often than not, we don't really have that at City now. I think that we've moved on to another era with, you know, a few of those players still there in the same status, the chief among them being obviously De Bruyne and Sterling. But Aguero is obviously kind of, he's 33 now, he's in and out that bit more. The defence is unrecognisable almost from what it was with Kyle Walker, almost one of the few stalwarts. And yeah, I think maybe the clock is running for some of those players while they're at the absolute peak, as Guardiola and the club try to kind of reintroduce a new, well, they try and basically create that Ferguson style succession. And it should be actually acknowledged. I mean, there's been a lot of talk about how this is the first time that Guardiola has ever spent more than four seasons at a club. And whatever about the challenge of that, what's actually been extremely rare in English football is a manager doing it with one team at a club and then going and doing it again. And the only two that have ever done that are Ferguson and Wenger.
Yeah, interesting. You know, we look at Chelsea through the prism of Frank Lampard's status and potential. What did you make of his comments about British coaches deserving more respect? Was there an element of self-protection in that, or was he making a valid, broader point?
To be fair to Lampard, I think he, in that situation, he was asked a question, and when you see it in context, it doesn't look as bad as the initial headlines made out. I mean, the initial headlines, it was impossible. My immediate reaction when I saw the headline was, hang on here, Frank. If anyone's is treated differently here, it's probably you, because there's no manager in the Premier League that has as many ex-teammates in the media or as many people that personally know him. And just by the nature of these things, it means they won't get criticised as much. So I think he's largely benefited from that. But when you actually see his point in context, it's more nuanced and there's a bit more fairness, I would say, about it.
Yeah, you know, I would look at, you know, someone like Sean Dyche and say, yes, he does deserve more credit. And obviously his Burnley team and Turf Moor are possibly one of the last things that Chelsea need after a long trip back from Russia. In that case, Art, they were really efficient there, weren't they? What did we see about an emerging Chelsea in Krasnodar?
When you look at what Chelsea did there, it was probably what was expected, even though other teams may not go there and win 4-0. I think the way they performed was very professional, and the players that got chances like Callum Hudson-Odoi and Hakim Ziyech impressed, and I think that's only going to be positive for Frank Lampard going forward, because with all the fixtures that are going to come up after the November international break in particular, he's going to need to call upon these players and have them at a consistent level where they can deliver for him. And when with other things, I feel getting that first win is going to be just as important, so that they can have more room to rotate as the group stage goes further on. And I feel with Ziyech in particular, he looked very sharp. I feel him getting minutes there can be great in terms of just getting that consistency in his rhythm to finally be introduced in the Premier League, where Chelsea may be able to come more consistent with him drifting in off that right side, being able to, yes, be a goal threat, but also look for his teammates where they may not have had that option beforehand with him coming back from that injury. And I feel just setting that statement of intent in the group stages this early, it's going to be a very promising thing for Chelsea going forward.
Yeah, when you look at it, 13 different scorers this season. Do we read anything into that? But also, while we're on a statistical theme, and this is a hat tip to Rich Jolly, who came out with the line that Maundy has as many clean sheets this month as Kepa has managed since January the 12th. You know, in the overall evolution of this team, one, how important is Maundy as a goalkeeper providing reassurance? And secondly, how critical is it that Lampard has a number of attacking options that he needs to refine as the season develops?
So from the goalkeeping aspect, I think just having someone who commands respect from the defence is as important as him being able to do the job well himself. I feel the way he's come into the Chelsea side, he's done exactly what everybody would have wanted in terms of being consistent in his performances, but also just being that figure that they can trust. I feel when you look at his decision-making, that's probably one of the things that Chelsea fans were hoping for most, and they've got that. Yes, he had that little bit of a scare at Old Trafford with that back pass, but I think when you look at the grand scheme of things, that's something that's going to happen with goalkeepers when they have the current demands that are on them in terms of being able to play out from the back. I think those little things are going to crop up every now and again, but on the whole, his distribution is something that Chelsea have benefited from and are going to as the season progresses. Of course, he's going to concede at some point, but the foundations he's laid are very promising going forward in terms of the attacking sense. I think what Frank Lampard's job is now is to figure out what is the best attacking quartet, maybe you can call it, to really push the side forward in the Premier League, and then find out who are the players who are more of deputies who can do the job in the Champions League and push those players to improve even more. You've seen the way Timo Werner's been used more off the left earlier in the season. Maybe that can change now in terms of Ziyech coming in and having another dimension off the right, which can open things up for Frank Lampard in an attacking sense. But yeah, I think the way Chelsea went about their business in the summer probably meant that there was going to be a period where it was going to be difficult to fit all of these players in and just find where they suit each other best as well as themselves. And I think that's something that Frank Lampard will find over the coming weeks with more players available to him.
Yeah. One thing that I'd like to just dwell upon a little bit, Miguel, is Leeds. Now, they're at home to Leicester on Monday. If they win that, we'll all be talking about them as potential league qualifying for Europe. I just want to concentrate on the case of Patrick Bamford. Is he a classic Bielsa player who's been made better on the training ground?
Yeah, I think completely. And also, I think this is a classic thing with a modern game as well, in that it's actually harder to separate in, I mean, if you think about it, like, especially does grow up and kind of doing ratings for newspapers and all that sort of thing. You know, 20 years ago, in the classic world of 4-4-2 and players knowing what were kind of traditional jobs, it was very easy to say, you know, to separate a player from his team and say how they're performing and how good they were, say. It was kind of more standard. Whereas now, given how much more tactically sophisticated the game is, how much more fluid the game is, and how players have, I mean, you know, if you were looking at it from that vantage of kind of the traditional 4-4-2 and what you'd expect the player to do, we would have certain expectations. But players now have such specific tactical instructions that even if it looks from the outside, they're not doing their job. A manager could be delighted because they're doing exactly what they want, and they're doing, even if it doesn't make sense to us. And talking to someone from Leipzig this week in the build up to the game, you know, and the way you put it, some modern instructions actually demand the players look like fools temporarily because of what the system does. And so my point here with Bamford is that a player can now look, regardless of their individual quality, a player can look completely different or offer a completely different perception depending on the system he's in. And a system can really alter the outlook of a player's career in that way. And I think I think he's completely a case in that in so many ways, but, you know, encouragement on the training grounds. I mean, there's that famous little clip of when Bamford scored a volley at training and Bielsa, you know, almost breaking from the public image we have of him, kind of mumbling with his head down, you know, running towards Bamford rapturously and giving him a massive bear hug. But also then the system that he puts him in and what he demands of him tactically, it's had this, you know, pronounced effect on Bamford's form and his impact.
Yeah, management coaching is a very complicated process, very multi-layered. Oh, I'd just like to look at West Brom as well. They're at Fulham in that early Monday slot. Are they in danger of a bit of self-inflicted damage here? Slaven Bilic was quite outspoken on the sale of Hegazi. You know, he said basically the club broke assurances they wouldn't sell the player. He can be headstrong. We're not looking at potentially the first managerial change of the season, are we?
It's a difficult decision to take because, of course, the way how outspoken he was, it doesn't fill you with confidence in him, I don't think, because you don't really expect your manager to come out against the club like that. That being said, I think they've chosen him. They should trust him for at least, well, longer than two months, in, not even 2 months into the season. Of course, we've seen clubs change much quicker than that. I think Frank de Boer is probably the best example at Crystal Palace a few seasons back. But Bilic has proven over the past decade that he can manage in the Premier League, that he is a manager to respect. And I think even though there is a little episode there with the whole sale, I think maybe pushing him out the door is a step too far. When you look at West Brom, you look at the way Darren Moore performed when he was given the chance there, and then they got rid of him, and everybody on the outside anyway was very surprised with his dismissal. And I think if they were to do the same with Bilic, you just get put in that cycle again. And that's not something any club would want, I don't think, just going in that merry-go-round of having a manager impress like Bilic did last season in the Championship and then dismissing him and trying to find that initial bounce again. So I think it's not a decision that should be taken in like any sort of haste, and that even though Bilic, especially since he's been in the Premier League, he's proven that he isn't going to hide his feelings. He isn't going to just sit back and accept whatever happens to him. He's going to speak out on these things. I don't think it's anything out of character really for him. And it's something that West Brom should just accept because they don't want to find themselves in that situation where they're a team who is already not expected to be in mid-table, etc., not putting themselves in a situation where they can derail things is probably more important than Bilic expressing his feelings on a certain sale.
Mm. Speaking of derailing things, Migs, what about the broader picture? It's a mess at the moment, isn't it? There's no surprise to learn that the top six were acting secretly in concert. You've got probably just as little surprise that Greg Clark, the FA chairman, his involvement was a little deeper and probably more damaging than he let on. Then you've got the Super League announcement, in inverted commas, at Barcelona, with the president, the parting president, basically delivering a political parting shot. What do you make of the bigger landscape at the moment?
Football is really kind of, it's almost on the edge of a huge fissure at the moment. A lot of people spoke of COVID being the opportunity for a reset. That is very much an ongoing process. And I think a huge problem is we have so many different parties, so many different interests, that it's impossible for any reset to actually happen. Because the game requires much more consensus. I think a problem is that COVID could expose all these problems, but we don't really have potential solutions. And I mean, I think the fundamental of all this is, and even what like a driving issue or a driving problem like financial disparity comes from, because it is financial disparity that really causes this huge problem in the game. And in England, that financial disparity, and it is beginning to have an effect in the rest of Europe as well, but it primarily comes from broadcasting revenue and the way it's distributed, and then also, of course, the global clubs that the kind of the top clubs have become. But all of this basically comes from the fundamental problem that football is a business with all the with all the business requirements. Like, essentially, I mean, business is ultimately about killing a competition to degree and business success now. But that is offset. The fundamental of sport is about competitive balance. So it's on one side, you've got something where you want to kill business. On the other side, kill competition. On the other side, you have a situation where every year you have to revive that competition for the health of the sport as a whole. And it feels like football has never quite solved this contrast, or this, what is it, almost this kind of paradox or dilemma. And it's led to this growth of problems and this growth of a gap at all levels. And all these issues now where we have so many different invested parties, everyone looking for their own piece of leverage. And it doesn't really look like it's going to get solved anytime soon, despite all these grand plans. I mean, I have to say, the Super League stuff, I take that with a pinch. I'm to be honest, I'm almost dismissive of it right now. The leaking of it initially felt almost opportunistic. It was interesting that despite Bartomeu's comments on Monday or Tuesday, whatever that was, even FIFA kind of dismissed it. It felt bizarre, but I mean, that's almost in keeping with Bartomeu's reign at Barcelona. And I wouldn't put too much stock in that at the moment, but it feels like we're going to be in a state of uncertainty in football for some time, and it could take quite a while for all this to settle down.
Taking everything that Migs said there, Art, we had Arsene Wenger coming out this week and saying that the Super League, or a European Super League, would destroy the Premier League. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, I think if you're going to take teams out of any league, so it wouldn't just be the Premier League, it would be leagues like La Liga, Serie A, Ligue 1 in France. Taking teams out of any league is going to be detrimental, even if it is to possibly create a, as they call it, Super League. When Mikel Arteta was, it wasn't a direct question about it, but he was asked about the strength of the Premier League yesterday in his press conference for tonight against Dundalk. And he said that in the past 8 to 10 months, he's seen the Premier League grow in strength more than ever before. And I think he wouldn't just come out and say that. He is a manager who, although he is very young, only 10 months in the job, he has spoken very much with honesty when he's been given the chance. And I think he wouldn't just come out and say that in a blasé kind of attitude. I think the way the Premier League has started this season especially has been kind of what maybe not what everybody would have wanted, but in terms of just a general view, having it a lot more balanced and that competition, as Miguel touched on, that competition does feel like it's back. And I think having that in the Premier League at this stage more than ever after the dominance of Liverpool and Manchester City in the last couple of years is as important to keeping that strength improving and hopefully not going down the route of the European Super League.
Yeah. Well, I'll draw it all together, if I may. Now, Art has a far better handle on what's going on at Arsenal than me, and most people, to be honest. To an external observer, the Mesut Ozil situation seems a mutually damaging mess. But with so much bad news around, I want to end on a positive note. Let's dwell on Mesut Ozil the person rather than Mesut Ozil the player. You know, you can doubt his temperament or his talent all you like, but you can never deny his humanity. He's providing 1,400 meals a day at 11 schools in the North London area during the half-term break. He's been funding food for charities and homeless shelters since the lockdown began in March. Cynics will say he can afford it, being paid about £1.4 million a month to do very little. I say to them, give it a rest. We should celebrate our footballers for acting on their social consciences. In the meantime, thanks to Miguel and Art, and to you for joining us here on the Football Writers Podcast.
Hey, folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF Podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.